Welcome to the About Sex podcast, where we discuss...
androids.
Nah, well, maybe a little bit. I actually do have a blog that just came out, androidslavery.com. It's called The Android's Guide to Enslaving the Human Race. It's autobiographical, and I talk about it from my perspective as an android. Mm-hmm. I'm really a person, but it's a little humor.
But really, the show's about sex, I hear.
Our show is about sex. That's my little plug. My name is Josh. I'm a writer. And with me, as always, is my lovely wife, Angela Skirtu. Tell us who you are, Angela.
I'm a licensed marriage therapist and an ASEX certified sex therapist. And today, our guest is Dr. Lori Bedito. Is that how I pronounce it?
Bedito, you got it.
Bedito. She did it. Doctor, well, I just want to make sure I have it correct.
We're off to a rousing start.
I know, like, right? Wow. Dr. Lori is a clinical psychologist with a specialty in sex therapy. And for the last 27 years, she's been doing radio and television. So, hey, why don't you tell us a little about yourself and put in a plug if anybody's interested?
Sure. So I am a clinical psychologist and a sex therapist in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. I have a nightly radio program that I've had for the last 19 years.
Wow.
That talks just about sex every night. So I answer people's questions about sex. We talk about all kinds of themes everything. There's nothing we don't talk about.
You talk about everything.
So I've been doing that every single night for 19 years.
Wow. How many shows have you done?
That's my night job.
How many shows?
How many shows have I done? Probably close to
5,000. Wow.
So we've actually done 85 episodes about sex, and I'm so sick of talking about sex. I don't know how you have done 5,000
episodes.
See,
and I love it. I understand. I would do the same.
Yeah, and there's always something to talk about. You know that.
Yeah.
There's always things that come out in the news and new topics. And I've had the privilege of seeing so many trends because I've been in the business for 30 years. That I started before the internet was a thing, right?
Yeah.
So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, it's an interesting evolution to see and being able to talk to all generations. And I have listeners who are in their 80s who have been following me for years.
Wow.
And they love to hear talk about sex. And I have the millennials who have their own questions, you know?
Yeah.
We recently found out we're elderly millennials.
Yeah, we're elder millennials because we're at the top of the spectrum.
You're elder, and I'm a young baby boomer. I'm the last of the baby boomers.
You're the last of the boomers. Congratulations.
Yeah. So it's quite, it's been really interesting. And in the last couple of years, a couple of years back when I was turning 50, I decided that it was time to talk about sex and aging. I was aging. My girlfriends were aging.
Yeah. And, I'm aging.
So I wrote a book. I wrote a book called The Sex Bible for People Over 50.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
so that was something that I really wanted to get across is that I was hearing in my practice, which is my day job, in my clinical practice, so many people who were just giving up on sex, like if they hadn't had it in a while or they had problems or ED or dry vaginas and they're like, I'm too old anyway. What the hell?
Up.
You know, that would get me so mad. You know, it's like you can have the best sex of your life after 50.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Because there's no fear of babies?
And with no fear of babies.
Yeah. You don't have to worry about birth control. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's sad,
we have
too.
Our issues, you know. Issues do come up as you age, obviously, and that's what the book addresses, all the potential issues, but it gives you all the solutions for it as well. Mm-hmm. So.
Oh, nice.
So what are the big changes to your sexuality for men, let's say, as you get past 50?
Well, I'll tell you that the biggest change I've noticed when I started practicing in sex therapy, my typical client with ED, erectile dysfunction, was somewhere in the range of 65 years old. Today, my typical erectile dysfunction client is anywhere between 25 and 35. So it tells you something of what's happening in the world, and that it has a lot to do with expectations. What I see is a lot of performance anxiety. So all these young men that come to see me, they think they have a physical problem, but none of it is physical. It's very rare that a young man is going to have medically induced somehow erectile dysfunction. It's just unless they're on antidepressants or something. But
it's all psychological.
Generally, it really is. Pardon?
It's all psychological.
it's psychological. It has a lot to do with the pressures they put on themselves. It has a lot to do with growing up on porn.
Yeah, I was wondering about porn. Like, because if there's this expectation.
Exactly. Exactly. So they have expectations of the way they should perform, or a fear of not making their partners explode in delight. I don't know. You know
we like explosions. We're big fans of that.
It's all right. It's good. It's fine. But that's not what most orgasms are like. So, but they don't know, and they have they build up these expectations, or they build of what they think. Their partners expect of them as well in terms of how long they should last. And porn is far from reality in terms of that kind of thing. So so I do see a whole lot of that. I see a lot more sex addiction as well. Porn addiction, sex addiction. I see a lot of couples who come in for issues of infidelity. That's always been an issue, but it's more out in the open. So people are far more willing and to seek out this kind of help, I think,
for infidelity.
Well, for all kinds of sex issues, right? Young people didn't used to come to sex therapists. Now it's okay. There's much less of a taboo, and part of it is because they talk more openly about sex. The younger generations are more exposed, so they talk more. We didn't have anything to go on except for Cosmo magazine or something. You know, we really didn't have much.
Well, and everybody knows that's the great reference, Cosmo magazine.
Oh yeah. I mean, listen, I'm not going to they bring out a lot of things to awareness and that's great, but if that's all you've got, that's not enough.
Right.
Well, so you mentioned porn a second ago. Aren't you the director of the sexual health of Pornhub?
Pornhub's sexual wellness center?
Yes, indeed. Yes.
So,
yes, so
what is that, and how did you get involved?
Yeah, how did you get that job? That's awesome.
It's a great job. I love it. I love it because it's international. I love it because I get to reach out to people from all over the world, and people have access to me from all over the world, which is an amazing thing.
That is awesome.
So I was looking, being in the media a lot, and I've been doing radio and TV and things like that for so many years, I was looking for a way to maybe expand, and they were looking for some kind of community project, education-based community project, and we just happened to have a person in common who put us in touch, and so together we came up with the Pornhub Sexual Wellness Center, which was not, at the beginning when it came out, people were really critical, saying that it was some kind of marketing ploy or something like that, which that was the furthest thing. I would never have gotten involved if that was the case.
Right.
It was really a online center, let's say, clinic, made for people who are already on the site. It wasn't made to draw people to Pornhub. It was really designed for the people who visit Pornhub so that they could get another, they get the other side, so they would have a more balanced view of sexuality.
Yeah,
and we've achieved that. We've had close to probably by now about 6 million visits.
Oh, wow.
I get hundreds and hundreds of questions each week from all over the world. And I can see the limited knowledge that people have, even though they go to porn to see whatever they want to see. But the knowledge that they have is so limited.
Well, they don't teach it.
Nobody teaches it.
Yeah,
it's kind of disappointing that's the reality. Nobody knows anything. And when you're using porn as your only education source, it's just not enough. And it's not really tailored to how do you talk to people? How do you get somebody into the bed?
Right. The only sex education
It's not tailored. It's not tailored to safety. It's not tailored to consent. It's not tailored to relationships, emotional connection. Like none of those things that most people are concerned about.
Yeah.
Yeah. That actually get people into bed together.
Right. Yeah. Like nobody ever teaches you that in school. Like how do you get a woman into bed?
But in a nice consensual way.
Right.
And how women can be assertive with their own sexuality.
Right.
Women
how you can find a partner.
For generations, right? Women have been taught that, or we've kind of learned that sex is something that we give to men, whereas really it's something that they should be taking for themselves. They have equal right to pleasure that men do.
Right.
And mm-hmm. so we need to be able to talk about pleasure within sex education. That doesn't get talked about at all. Go find that in a course at school.
No, they never mentioned the clitoris.
No, they never mentioned pleasure because that might make people have sex.
The education I had was mostly just about disease and how you shouldn't do it. And hygiene. And oh no, if you get pregnant, you're going to ruin your life. That was it. I grew up in Texas, so they're very liberal there. Right. No.
Except that in Texas, for example, what's so interesting is that in the states where they're the most conservative about sex, that's where they have the higher number of people going to porn.
Right, and they have the higher teen pregnancy rates.
And everybody, STD rates.
Like, everybody I knew was pregnant in high school. Like, I actually had a girlfriend who...
Really?
I stopped dating her, and then a few months later...
She was pregnant.
A friend came up to me, and she said, "Did you get her pregnant?" I was like, "No, we never even had sex." She was like, "Oh." Apparently, she dated another Josh right after me.
Oh.
And she got pregnant.
But that's the point. With that lack of education, people can't protect themselves.
Right, yeah. Like and lack of access to things like condoms and birth control. Like, I had zero access to that as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
well, it's all fear, right? It's all fear-based. And so when you do it fear-based, most teenagers have brains that don't really look at fear. They don't have fear. No. Or they have the attitude that that's not going to happen to me kind of thing.
Right,
or they have all
it.
These misconceptions, like you can't get pregnant on the first time you have sex.
Right.
Or, whatever it is.
I knew a girl who did.
And certainly... And in the states where you've got abstinence-only education, well, that's a big that bond. That just doesn't work
at all.
All the studies show quite the opposite. So. Yeah.
What kinds of questions do people ask you on your show or at the Pornhub site?
Oh my goodness, I get all kinds. So on my show, some of the more typical questions are things like, how can I last longer in bed? So a lot of people with premature ejaculation.
Yeah.
How can I, what can I do to make my penis bigger?
wait, can you do that?
I think weighting them down.
I don't think you can do that. It's kind of sad.
No, you can't. You can't.
Like, I hear there are surgeries for it, but they're not, you don't want to do that.
No. There's no, really, the only surgery that exists is only to make you a shower, not a grower. In other words, it can pull out, like if you cut the ligaments at the base.
Oh no.
Because part of the penis, there's about an inch or so that's in the body.
Uh-huh.
So all it does is releases the ligaments. It releases that part.
Releases the Kraken.
Releases the Kraken.
Releases the Kraken.
So yeah, you really can't make it bigger.
Oh no.
You only appear bigger... flaccid, but it does nothing for erection.
Yep.
So
and you just have to be happy with what you have. I mean,
well, and become a generous lover. I think that works.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yep. There are other digits you can use.
Other parts.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, men don't understand. Also, what I find is a lot of people are concerned why they don't orgasm with intercourse,
mm-hmm.
and they don't realize that 75% of women. Don't orgasm with intercourse alone.
Right.
They do need some form of clitoral stimulation. And they have no idea about the clitoris either, that it's a much bigger structure than what they think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And women the same. I find women don't know their bodies at all. And this is something that I try to teach women about their bodies too. Mm-hmm. So all of these misconceptions and just misinformation or lack of information leads to sometimes pretty bad sex.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm always shocked at how bad sex people are having. I'm a sex therapist as well. And, you know, often I'll say to my clients, you have no idea what you guys are missing, man. Like, this is terrible sex.
Yeah.
And many women have never even looked at their vaginas. I'm like,
that's right.
That's crazy.
You know, I give a talk. I do a lot of speaking. So one of the things I ask if I have a full room of women is how many of you ladies, if we lined up your vulvas in a row, how many of you could pick yours out?
In a lineup? I can pick hers out.
Not a hand goes up, you know, like, or two hands go up. You ask the same question to a group of guys, and every hand goes up.
Of course.
We're showers.
Well, it is more obvious. I mean, you touch it every single day. It's there.
Yeah. Every day. Trust
sometimes
me.
multiple times, Josh. No, but the reality is I think women are very ashamed of their bodies, and culture's kind of created that for them. Yeah. And men, too, to some degree.
What? men too.
That's all certainly part of it, and the trend now is more men are getting plastic surgery, more men are getting all the things that traditionally were female kind of things that to better their physical being. More men are in the gym these days.
More men have anorexia.
We live in a culture like that.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Men have a lot more pressure to have an image of beauty.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but and where does that come from? Again, it comes from the media, it comes from porn.
And social media, we're always on.
Yeah, like, everybody's doing those selfies.
You gotta take seven selfies a day or you don't exist. Yeah. Like, if you didn't take a photo of it, it didn't happen. Sorry.
That's true. You didn't have a life experience. It's not documented.
And I joke about it, but I take photos all the time.
We're such millennials.
I love taking photos. I actually go on a hike right up the road, and I take photos there every time. And it's the same hike.
You know, it's the same hike.
It's so interesting. I was speaking about selfies and photos. I just came back from a trip to Spain, and it's the most beautiful country, and so I wanted to make sure I captured it. But then, of course, I kept having to stop myself, put my phone away, and say, just be in this moment.
Yeah, just enjoy
where
it.
You are and absorb the grandeur of what you're seeing
right.
rather than through the lens. Like, I really had to stop myself to be able to do that. We have to become far more conscious of that kind of thing now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You have to remind yourself to actually, like, be present in a moment.
You have to be mindful.
Which, by the way, mindfulness is really good for sex, too. I don't know if you ever use mindfulness as a tactic,
but
like, be present for your sexual experience.
Oh, I have to
Who
be there?
Heard of that?
What do you mean? I have to not check out?
Yeah, Josh. So much work.
Tell me what to do.
Women are far more likely to check out than, it's not that they check out, it's that their mind, they have a much harder time compartmentalizing. So a guy could let go of all his work stuff easier to get right into it. So if he's horny, he's horny, and that's good enough.
Mm-hmm.
But women need time to empty their brains. They need time to relax their bodies. Like, it becomes a bit more complex because this is what women need. But if we understand what women need, then their partners will get what they want as long as they are able to help their partners get what they need as well, which might be a massage, which might be help with the kids, which might be just give me an hour to myself. I mean, it could mean any of those things to be able to be present and enjoy her own body.
Right. You have to have that self-care.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Actually, I did one of the things I wouldn't mind talking about is I did a TED Talk on female sexuality and female desire, which I think is important. It's very like a 12-minute talk, but it encapsulates a little bit the whole concept of how we need to look at female desire, not through the lens of men's desire, but through women's eyes and women's real experience. Because up to a certain, I mean, this is another change I've seen, of course, in 30 years, is that by looking at women's sexuality through the man lens, which is the old Masters and Johnson kind of look, we miss out. We start to assume and think that a ton of women have sexual problems.
Could you maybe explain a little bit about some of the differences for some of our listeners who don't know about that Masters and Johnson model? Like, what would you say are some of the differences between the male and female?
So the Masters and Johnson approach is a very linear approach. It's about desire leading to arousal, leading to erection and then ejaculation, or lubrication and then orgasm. So
it's very mechanical.
Desire. It implies that you're horny first, then you get aroused, and then you go on with it, right?
I see.
Okay.
But what we find with women is that desire doesn't necessarily come first. Sometimes. Yeah. And many times, especially in long-term relationships, arousal comes before desire. So you have to look at a woman's motivation for sex is not simply because she's horny. And I'm talking about women, let's say, in long-term relationships. She may have lost that spontaneous desire for sex, but she hasn't lost her responsivity to sexual stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
So if if her motivation for sex is not being horny, it's got to be something else. So what are those something else? It has to be a wanting to be intimate, wanting to be close, wanting to show affection and love and all of those things. Mm-hmm. So if she's pissed off at her partner, there's no motivation for it. No.
Nobody wants to have sex with a dick.
No, there's very
little. Nobody wants to have sex with a dick.
Nobody wants an angry hand job.
Yeah. That's right.
Usually the guy can do it, right? It doesn't matter if he's pissed off.
Well, that's not actually true. Like, we talked
not
about
always.
Performance anxiety. I mean, if a guy's in his own head, like, he can have his own issues. Like,
yeah.
But, I mean,
I'm
anger is one of the ones.
Have issues.
Anger is one of those ones that you can kind of push through.
I mean, anger can kind of feel like passion.
You're like,
they're similar.
Ah,
all
right, get you.
No, I'm so mad.
I'm so mad and hard as a rock.
Might be?
What?
The difference might be that some men can use sex to get rid of those feelings, right? So as a way
catharsis.
To resolve mm-hmm. the issue.
Yeah, we call it angry sex.
Resolve the issue.
Yeah. It's like, you need a spanking.
Oh, yes.
You're such a bad girl.
I always need a spanking, but that's a different story, Josh.
She does. She's so bad.
Yeah, that's a different show.
No, but so what you're saying is there's different motivations for why a woman might get herself to arousal.
Exactly. And then once she's motivated by whatever it is that motivates her, and she allows her partner to arouse her and can be in that moment, then the desire will kick in. So generally speaking, I know these are generalizations, but this has certainly been my observation, especially in long-term relationships, is that then women will respond to that arousal and the desire will then kick in and they want to continue and then they can have great sex. Because I speak to a lot of women who tell me they have low desire. So I explore and then I ask them, well, what happens when you do have sex? And they almost invariably say, oh, the sex is great. Mm-hmm. So we talk about, well, how do we get from point A to point B, right? Mm-hmm. We've got to get to the, not necessarily the, feeling horny part of it, but what conditions do you need to be open to sex, and sex is good anyway?
Oh, I can tell you the conditions. Like, I think a lot of women, I think a lot of couples, they get into that, they've been together a long time, and you drop off on the trying, and you just expect it to happen.
Yeah,
and
they expect
the reality
it spontaneously.
Is, my wife is turned on when I help her with chores around the house.
That's
when I
right.
when
you
I buy
it.
Her flowers. When I
when he puts effort
when
in.
When I put effort into doing
when
things
for her.
When
he rubs my feet, that works
when
out.
When I show up and have a good attitude
that's
about
right.
it too.
Oh yeah,
like
that's a really
present.
Important one. I love that you point that out because sometimes guys will go on dates, but they'll like do it because they have to rather than coming with a good
well,
attitude.
Why are
like...
you married to them then?
Some guys like begrudgingly go on dates, and I'm like, yeah, that's not going to work out for you.
Why are you begrudgingly married? How about that?
Well, first of all marriage is a little bit begrudging, to be
oh,
fair.
Sure. But don't do something unless
but
it makes you happy.
But also, people assume that once you're married, marriage takes care of it all. Like,
oh,
it should.
No.
Oh, no.
That's it. That's all you need, or all you need is love to keep it going. No, you need far more than love. Love is actions anyway.
Yeah.
So it's not just a feeling, it's full of actions. Mm-hmm. And once you stop acting in a loving way, you're not going to get what you want. You will not have that fulfilling relationship.
Nope. Mm-hmm. You got to work for it. The honeymoon period, the first couple of years, it's easy. But as soon as you get out of
that's
there,
the
like,
easy part.
That's,
oh,
the,
yeah.
easy
that's
part.
The easy part.
If only we could live on honeymoon.
I remember we were in that era. We were like, marriage is so easy. We're so
easy,
great at this. Oh, we're so good at this.
I love you so much.
Oh, and then, oh no. This
what happens? Life happens.
Life happens. Like, bad things happen.
Couples
and,
will,
yeah.
Couples will often say, like, oh, we had like so much sex at the beginning, and why can't we get that back? And and I often respond, well, can you get your virginity back? Like, you can't get the beginning back. You can't. Mm-hmm. That is a phase of a relationship. And
maybe retrograde amnesia.
No. Yeah.
Maybe we could work on that. Yeah.
Because
just
then,
hit me in the head, Angela.
So you're saying we can't get our virginity back or the first phase? No.
You can't go back to the honeymoon ever.
What but can you
people
get?
Want that. People say that, right? They say, I want us to go back to how it was.
Yeah.
And I get a lot of men who say to me things like, I feel like I've been sold a bill of goods, you know, like I've been robbed, like I've been cheated, I've been lied to.
Marriage was something different in the beginning, and you learn that that's what marriage is, and you act like that's what marriage is, and all of a sudden it changes, and you don't know what to do. And I don't think anybody's bad for acting that way, because the reality is no one tells you
nobody tells stuff. You what it takes no to one tells make you it what last. It takes
yeah. to make a marriage last, and they, you get into it, and well, you it's good, it's fun, and then everything falls apart and you don't know what
and
to
then
do
what?
Yeah, then you go right. see a therapist
and we give you the answers
and they you give them all your money and maybe they help.
Well, hopefully they help.
Hopefully they help. Yeah, I know.
But I mean,
my wife's a therapist.
Yeah, most of what I do is a lot of couples counseling. But yeah. If we had courses, mm-hmm. pre-marriage courses
in high school,
where we could talk about these changes, where we could talk about the potential pitfalls, and where we could talk about what needs to be nurtured and how, mm-hmm. then I think we would people would save a lot of money and a lot of heartache.
Yeah, I think we should teach it in middle and high school. Like, I think we should teach how to have a relationship, how to get a relationship.
Mm-hmm. How I think to, that would be good in pre-parenting classes, too.
How to have a family, how to yeah. be a parent. Yeah. Like, nobody.
Like, what's it take to get this going?
Teenagers don't look that far ahead, so you can talk to them about healthy relationships. We know that teen violence, like, teen violent relationships is very common.
Mm-hmm.
And why is that happening? That means we're not talking about healthy relationships. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of kids that may come from their own violent homes or other issues, yeah. and they kind of think that's normal.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't know what normal is aside from what they grew up in, which is normal
right.
to them.
Right. Mm-hmm. They grew up in a blender. So they pay it forward.
Yeah, well, sometimes, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, but it would be good to have something for high school and maybe college, too, since the high schoolers, sometimes they're probably not retaining all that information.
You remember
exactly.
some of it.
I remember some of
that's
it.
That's when you start
sure.
dating. I mean, if you have those tools at that time,
really,
it
we
might
just
be
need
a
to do
easier.
It across the lifespan, you know? Like, and there's always materials and things out there. I mean, that's why they have the Pornhub sexual health
and, you know,
stuff now.
I don't think the way it should be taught is just, like, lecture. I think the reality is, like, group therapy almost. It's
yeah, like interactive.
When you're actually having a relationship and being able to talk about it in an mm-hmm. open way, non-judgmental, and it's better really to talk about it when you're not pissed at each other. But that's when we wait to go to therapy.
Yeah. Oh no, yeah. My favorites.
Angela's right that it should be something at every stage of life. Mm-hmm. Education should be there. It's mm-hmm. not something you do once. Sex education is not something you do once.
No, everybody should be a lifetime learner.
To start from kindergarten. All the way through high school, all the way through college.
All the way through your adulthood, really.
And adulthood, yeah.
Well, exactly. Really, maybe everybody should become a sex therapist because, I mean, we're lifelong sex learners, and I still learn new stuff every year. Maybe not every day as much anymore, but every year I learn new things, and my friends are always trying to throw new things at me, like, Angela, did you hear about this thing?
I'm like what? What did you learn this year?
It's always weird things.
Yeah.
Well,
there's so many new terms and so many, there's such variation in
like
sexuality
a
that 30 years ago, we didn't hear about.
Yeah, we learned about a thruple. I also learned you should avoid fisting to avoid vaginal tearing today.
Yeah.
There you go.
But I think I already knew that one.
Yeah.
I'm always learning new stuff, though. And that's the reality. Like, I think that it just should be a lifelong learning experience because mm-hmm. there's so much, like, at every stage, even why you needed to write your sex Bible for the 50-year-olds and above, is that there's always new information that you need even as you age because you don't realize that your body's going to change.
Yeah, your sex life changes
absolutely.
In every different
decade. And you know what's
decade.
So interesting is if we talk about the lifespan, one of the things I do is I give talks I go to seniors' homes, so retirement communities and retirement homes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's what we know now is that the rate of sexually transmitted infections is just as high
mm-hmm.
in the 65 plus than it is in the 25 year olds. Just as high.
Just
so
as high.
There, that's a generation of people. And most of the people I talk to are in their, never mind that, they're in their 80s even.
Yeah.
Most of that generation didn't grow up with condom use. Condoms were for one thing, and it was to prevent pregnancy,
mm-hmm.
and then they end up in these residences, which are They're like college dorms, really.
I can't wait to go to the old folks' home. It's going to be a party every night.
You're
going to
have a great life, Josh, especially like, if you live that long.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, I'm going to die young.
I hear the men are in high supply.
If you live that long, you might want, if you live that long and you're single, go. Yeah. You might want to move in there. Yeah. Lots more women to men, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
But I have a lady every night, all the time.
So they have a lot of issues with STDs passing around because they don't use condoms at all?
Yeah, they mess around. Like they don't, they have, many of them are perfectly capable too. You don't necessarily develop, not every man develops erectile dysfunction. Like it right. may not be as hard as it once was, but it's hard enough to fool around. But, and so, yeah, that's we're nice. Seeing all kinds of stuff. And I go in there and I give them safe sex talks and I tell them, I do demos on how to put on condoms, and the oldest person that bought my book was 95. Wow. 95-year-old man bought my book.
That's a pretty good, like...
That's a good track.
Kudos, because that's somebody who's in 95 years old, so they're going to take the time to read your book. They don't got a lot of time left. They're taking time out of their life for
you. They're going to live their life to the fullest.
Yeah, that's awesome.
He took a bunch of the free condoms I was offering, and I go there with a big basket of condoms. I leave with nothing. They're all taken. Clearly, they're using them.
So you also talk a little bit about autism and sexuality. Like, what is the
another area that I got involved in about 10 years ago or so is working with couples where one person is on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. So usually with obviously very high functioning autism like Asperger's, mm-hmm. although we don't use that term anymore, but yes. And also where one person may have or has ADHD. And those two brain functionings, like they're not neurotypical, they're more atypical, but often can create problems in relationships. Mm-hmm. And in adulthood, it can go undiagnosed simply because we didn't have, back then when they were kids, we didn't have the tools to measure this anyway. So these are people that grow up and they have jobs and, you know, normal stuff, but there's something particular about them and it affects their relationships, mm-hmm. and they end up having far more trouble in their relationships because the negotiating, compromising, the communication is difficult, more difficult. So they end up in my office more often than not. And in fact, studies have shown that couples where one person is not neurotypical, so ADHD or Asperger's, the rate of divorce is not like 50%, it's more like 80%.
Well, that's pretty high.
Yeah, but often the couples who come in don't know that that's the issue.
They don't know.
They come in, like, you'll have, I'll take a female who comes in saying, my husband never listens to me, he never cares, he never remembers things, therefore he doesn't care enough to listen to me, blah, blah. And really what it's about is that he can't. Like, there's a won't and there's a can't.
Yeah.
And my job is to look at what's the can't and what's the won't. Mm-hmm. And when they finally understand that it's a question of adapting to the can't so that you find tips and tricks and things that they will remember or ways of dealing with things, it changes the whole dynamic because now the other partner isn't taking it personal. So it's not about me.
Yeah. So they finally understand their partner a little bit. Yeah, I think that's important to understand.
They have trouble with attention. You know, I've had clients who they have to put things in their phone to remember it. Or like I had this one client who used Post-it notes so he could remember. And he'd take one Post-it note at a time and read that and do it. Because otherwise, you know, squirrel, he'd be off on another tangent.
I'm the same way. Like I have a little bit of ADD. Josh definitely has that. Oh, yeah. What were we talking about?
Oh, well, listen, I learned it too. My husband has ADD, and it took me a while to realize he has ADD because he was never really diagnosed as a child. But, man, there were things that would drive me up a wall. Like, I would ask him to do three things. I need you to do these three things. And if I got, I was
one
lucky
at a time.
One thing got done. You know? And I was like, can't you listen to me?
No. Or the worst is when they start projects but don't finish them. So they started the three projects. Mm-hmm. Like the laundry is in the washer.
Yeah.
But it's wet and it's been there for 3 days.
But it got washed.
You know what I learned to do? Angela? I hire other people.
Yep.
Oh, I always hire the others.
Oh, yeah.
I hire other people. I have a handyman. I call him my second husband, you know? And he does everything my husband won't do.
Right.
Or forgets to do or whatever. So I call him because I know he'll show up and he will do it.
Well, there's value if you have money to do that, but then sometimes for the other clients, there needs to be phones and maybe things to remind them, like whiteboards.
But yeah, it's nice to be able to pay
someone. You try to get in friends or other people who can kind of help.
Oh,
But the other part of it, too, is if you look at, let's say we take somebody who has Asperger's. Someone who has Asperger's has trouble with the social aspect of life. They're super bright and can have great jobs and are really, really good at what they do. And they're highly intelligent, but socially, they have trouble reading cues. They have trouble with empathy, and in a relationship, if the other person isn't on the spectrum, they're expecting their partner to read their cues. They're expecting their partner to know when they're sad, when they're upset, when all of that.
But you know, men always struggle with women expecting them to be mind readers, though. Yeah. That's always been a problem.
That's kind of been since the dawn of time. Like, women will say, we can't read
your
minds.
You should know why I'm mad at you. It's like, well, no. I mean, sometimes you just need to communicate.
Yeah.
Like, imagine people off the spectrum. Imagine that amplified so much more, right? So that's difficult. And sometimes affection is difficult, like knowing when somebody needs a hug, or some of the stuff we do spontaneously, we don't even think about. It takes a lot of effort on the part of somebody who has Asperger's. So we can train, we can teach, we can model, we can do these things to help the couple as well. But the other person, the neurotypical person, has to also understand that this is something they can't do or have a lot of trouble doing, not because of the partner, but simply because of who they are and how their brain works. And in terms of just processing information, you can't have hour-long conversations and expect your partner to absorb it all. Somebody else might, but somebody on the spectrum won't. And somebody with ADD won't either. So you learn to talk in smaller bites.
Mm-hmm. Or while they're walking, I get them doing projects and they seem to take things in better because their brains are going so fast.
Like, I heard like if they are talking or doing something they really are passionate about, though, they can focus, right?
Mm-hmm. To some degree, you can get really focused on that.
That's right, then they can focus.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Well, but if you get them in a project that they're doing, sometimes that can help slow down the brain a little bit, depending on the client. This is usually more for ADHD than on the Asperger's side, but because they're just so smart and their brains are going so fast, like if I have them take a walk with the dogs and then talk, or if one of the ADHD person is driving, then they have a better conversation.
Yeah.
I'm worse when I'm driving. I'm too distracted.
Depends on the person.
Yeah, it makes sense.
But walking is good.
Yeah. Yeah, it depends on the person. You have to, like, fiddle around with it, of course. Yeah. But, like, everybody's different, and I can definitely see that issue.
Yeah, or, like, mindfulness helps.
Yeah, mindfulness helps. Or even, you know, it's funny because I'll see people on the Asperger's. They'll either be very hypersexual or almost under-sexual. Like,
or the other way.
Yeah, they're very extreme one way or the other.
Yeah,
and that's got to be
hard. And sometimes quite mechanical about sex. Mm-hmm. So it can be a... It can be mechanical, and also they may have more, there's a greater likelihood of fetishes in people with Asperger's.
Hmm.
Studies have shown that as well.
Interesting.
Because they're more fluid in their sexuality.
They are.
Actually.
Well, we actually had a man with autism on our show, and he was actually homosexual, and he was definitely more open to talking about sex and all these crazy stuff. He is actually a sex therapist.
He's a sex therapist now.
He was one of my favorite guests.
He talked about masturbating and they told him you have to like beat your monkey or something. And he would actually beat his penis.
He literally punched his penis.
He literally punched it because he thought he was supposed to beat it. Yeah. Like beating it off.
That's right. But that's the problem. It's the literal.
Literal.
We take everything literally. Just, so you have to adapt your communication to that as well, uh-huh. and then constantly working with couples to kind of explain that and see how that works.
Do you think people with autism, as they get older, they get better at dealing with the not understanding literal things like that? Like,
I'm not sure they get better spontaneously like that. I haven't quite seen that, but I think that if they have a partner that communicates in a way that they can process, it can certainly be it's certainly beneficial. But also they'll recognize the same things that they do. They might recognize it and say, oh yeah, I took that literally. Okay, right, you told me that before. Or so they can learn that with time, you know.
And maybe they learn to like question it, you know, and not take it for granted if it sounds a little bit off to them, you know.
Yeah.
So hopefully. Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes harder to recognize when something is off. That's part of the problem, but in a partnership, that certainly helps out. I have people who are on the spectrum who are single, and I will often tell them, like, it's okay for you to tell your partner that these are the areas that you might need, that you may have difficulty with, so that they understand it's not about them, that this is just this is just the way you are. It's just those are your quirks.
Yeah, and that might make it helpful to actually, you know what you're getting into. So it's like, oh, this isn't you being a jerk. This is just you taking something literal.
This is just who you are. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's more that's like right. you don't want to hide who you are to your partner. You want them to know you so they can love you for who you are.
Yeah, for who you are.
Because if you're hiding yourself, they're going to find it out later and then just be frustrated and not understand you.
Yeah, that's true.
So. That's right. And they may not know what it is. They may not know how to identify it. So if you know it, you may want to point that out. And I mean, Asperger, one thing I know about often people on the spectrum, they're very, very faithful individuals. So they're very loyal,
very loyal,
generally speaking, very loyal. So that's a very attractive quality, of course. And along with their out of the box thinking and their creativity, and this is what makes Asperger's so attractive, and this is what the partners tell me often, is that they just found that differentness so attractive.
Interesting.
Well, but it's also challenging. It's like two sides of the coin, right?
Right.
Yeah, everything and that you love about your partner, you can anything. Hate.
Right.
Yeah, you and can hate, exactly.
You can find, with any partner, whether they're on the spectrum or not, you're going to...
Exactly.
Yeah, you're going to have different things that attract you to them, and maybe
yeah, like the person who's laid back later becomes lazy. It's the same thing.
Right, exactly. You have to keep flipping that coin so that you can stay loving, you know?
Well,
everybody, we all have that. I don't know anybody whose partner doesn't drive them crazy in some respect, right?
Nobody's perfect. That's the reality,
But as long as you're crazy is the right kind of crazy to keep going with.
You just have to...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you got to love them for their flaws and for all the awesome parts about them, too. Yeah.
Well, I think that's about as much time as we have. Thank you, Dr. Lori, for showing...
That was a great episode. I really love talking about autism.
Did you want to put in a couple extra blogs? What am I thinking?
Wait, you got any plugs?
Plugs! I couldn't say. Well, put in your plugs.
Angela, words.
I can't say words.
It's very simple. If you just go to my website, drlaurie.com, drlaurie.com, on there, you can watch the TED Talks I did. I did one TED Talk on female sexuality and one TED Talk on long-term relationships, sex and long-term relationships. So people can get information about that and information about my book, The Sex Bible for People Over 50, which is available on Amazon and booksellers. And I would love people to visit our Pornhub center as well. And the way to just get access to that without going through any of the porn is pornhub.com/sex. I know that sounds crazy, but that's what it is. If you do /sex, you'll get to a non-sexual site.
Right. You probably still don't want to try to go to it while you're at work, though.
Yeah, you probably still want to do that at home.
Yeah, you probably shouldn't. Yeah, you might get in trouble for that.
Don't do it at school or work.
And of course, I'm Angela Skirtu, and if you want to see me, it's www.therapistinst.louis.com. And I actually have two books, too. One is actually a premarital counseling book, because I thought it was important to talk about sex for people growing up. But it's premarital counseling. Counseling, A Guide for Clinicians, and then Helping Couples Overcome Infidelity, A Therapist's Manual.
Yeah. And I'm Josh. I'm a writer. And you can check out my new blog. It actually just came out today. I finally have something to plug.
Yay!
It's The Android's Guide to Enslaving the Human Race. It's at www.androidslavery.com. And it's autobiographical. It's weird. Check it out. And this has been the About Sex podcast. We've been talking with Dr. Lori. Be sure to add us on Facebook, review us on iTunes, and send us your questions to aboutsexpodcast@gmail.com. I'm Joshua Skirtu.
And I'm Angela Skirtu. Stay kinky, St. Louis.